Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for oral submission on the 9 o'clock docket. We'll recess, and then we'll return for the 10:30 docket. Your panel this morning is, to my right, Justice Bob McCoy. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dauphineau. Before we start, I'd like to take a moment to remember two lawyers, Joe Johnson Jr. and Bill Willis. We have a moment of silence, please. Thank you. All right, I understand both sides are ready on the first case. Is that right?
Ready, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
All right, would you call the first case, please? Darren.
Thank you. May it please the court. Frontier's appeal before this court presents two primary issues. One, does Frontier have the capacity to bring this contract cause of action? In other words, does it own the right of the cause of action? The second question before this court is whether D.R. Horton has shown beyond any genuine dispute of material fact that they did not breach the contract. Starting with the first question of capacity, there are two independent reasons why Frontier does in fact own the right to bring this breach of contract cause of action. The first one is an assignment from Verizon to Frontier. That assignment occurred in July of 2010, effectively occurred in July of 2010. That assignment assigned all rights under the marketing contract between Verizon and D.R. Horton to Frontier. And that assignment was expressly governed by New York law. So the assignment that existed solely between the two parties, Verizon and Frontier, was a New York contract. And New York has expressly determined, as we've shown in our briefing, that the language passing the breach of contract cause of action from Verizon to Frontier is effective. In the Bank of Rob case, the Second Circuit decided under New York law, it was quite clear that the language in that case and the assignment language in that case that was analyzed by the Second Circuit is parallel in all material respects to the assignment language that was present in the assignment here. And we placed that language side by side in our briefing for the court's reference.
And the assignment is from and to?
It is from Verizon Services to Frontier Northwest, Inc.
Okay. Now, how are we going to get from Frontier Northwest, Inc. to the appellant in this case?
Great question. That's something that I believe you're referring to the misnomer issue.
Well, that's what how you term it.
Okay. No, that's fair. I believe that D.R. Horton raised that issue for the first time as they conceded on appeal. As we've said in our briefing, we believe that's an issue of capacity. There are Texas state court cases, both from the Supreme Court and appellate courts, the Supreme Court being the Nutzi opinion and the Pledger opinion, that indicate that ownership of a cause of action is a matter of capacity. And matters of capacity can be waived in the lower court if they are not raised. And D.R. Horton makes no argument that they raised them in the lower court. So I would say first and foremost that that issue is need not be addressed by this court. But secondly, on just the pure substance of that issue, the question of misnomer itself, again, this is a New York contract governed by New York law. And D.R. Horton concedes in its briefing that the rights between the two parties here being Verizon and Frontier Northwest, governed by New York law. And so looking to New York law, and specifically the Spanierman case, which we cited in our briefing, makes it quite clear that a technical misnaming in a contract document does not affect the substantive rights of the parties. And by the way, that's the same law in Texas, and it's the same law in Washington. Both states have expressed cases to that effect. And I think that's quite important. It's logical. Courts are not going to penalize parties in a punitive fashion for a simple misnomer. And here, just as it is in the other cases cited, it's quite clear that Verizon did not intend to assign a breach of contract action to a complete stranger to the contract. In other words, Frontier Northwest, Inc. And D.R. Horton has pointed out in its own briefing that Frontier Northwest, Inc. is a party organized under Washington law that is a complete stranger, I believe in their own words, to this contract. However, the assignment and assumption agreement between Verizon and Frontier makes it quite clear that they were assigning the marketing contract to Frontier Communications Northwest Inc., the party that was obtained by Frontier through the merger and distribution agreement, as it says in the assignment and assumption agreement.
So in two sentences, your first two arguments are the anti-assignment clause, the non-waiver clause, are void under case law, and it's misnomer. Even though there is an existing Frontier Northwest Inc. entity, that's not the entity here.
Absolutely.
Okay, go ahead.
And to finish with the anti-assignment agreement, because I think now we have to shift to Washington and Oregon law, which again is not disputed by the parties, right? We agree that Washington and Oregon law govern the marketing contract and therefore the anti-assignment agreement. So an anti-assignment agreement is the policy behind enforcing an anti-assignment agreement is that parties do not have to deal with each other. A party to a contract does not have to deal with a complete stranger to the contract. However, as numerous courts, including Texas, including Oregon, including Washington, have all held, an anti-assignment agreement is not effective against the assignment of a cause of action. You don't get to pick who you litigate against. You might get to pick who you're going to perform with, but not who you're going to litigate against. And here, D.R. Horton's primary argument on that point appears to be some additional language in the Bershauer decision that says, oh, that's only true, an anti-assignment clause isn't effective only if the contract is fully executed. Our first answer to that is that the Washington courts did not say that if the contract is executory, then a cause of action cannot be assigned. They didn't say the second half of that, and there's no Washington case that we found or that D.R. Horton's pointed to that holds that. But secondly, and I think really more fundamentally in this case, are D.R. Horton's own statements throughout the cause of action that indicate what the state of this contract is. Their first statement is on page 3 of their brief before this court in their statement of facts. And I'll read the second half of the first full paragraph, the first sentence in the first full paragraph. Its, Frontier's, claims have nothing to do with performance of that contract, referring to the marketing contract, after the attempted assignment. And that's true because...
Where are you reading?
I'm sorry. Page 3.
Page 3.
Of D.R. Horton's brief.
Yeah, I'm on there.
Okay. First full paragraph, and I'll read the whole sentence. Frontier never made any payments under the marketing contract, and its claims have nothing to do with performance of that contract after the attempted assignment. The performance of this contract is not before the court. The cause of action for breach of contract is what's before this court.
But what was being assigned?
The contract.
But a minute ago you said you can't assign causes of action. I'm hearing that. That's different from assigning the contract or the rights and duties under the contract.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So in the Bank of Rob case, Frontier, in many cases, this is true. all rights under the contract are assigned. When that occurs, the breach of contract cause of action is assigned right along with it. That's what New York law holds. In the Bank of Rob case, the Bank of Rob case specifically looked at language that mirrors the language in this case. The Bank of Rob case did not have a specific assignment of a cause of action. It assigned all the contract rights. And the Second Circuit held that was sufficient to pass the breach of contract claim, and in fact held that it was sufficient to assign tort claims arising from the breach of contract. So what we would hold is, or what we would say here, is that that breach of contract action passed. Now, if D.R. Horton was arguing that they didn't consent to us being on the other side of the contract and continuing to perform with them under the contract, that would be a different question. But that's not the question here. The question here is, do we have a right to bring a breach of contract action for past performance? And it seems to me that Texas, Oregon, and Washington have all held that that's the case, and that here, this contract has been assigned. I mean, this contract has been fully performed. And I'll point to another statement on page 15, the very first sentence on page 15 of Appellee's brief, and it says, Frontier correctly states that D.R. Horton last submitted homes for payment of commissions in June of 2010, the month before the effective date of the assignment of this contract. And so, keeping that in mind, we're not talking about, and we have no arguments with even the narrowest reading of the Bershauer case from the state of Washington, that this contract was fundamentally fully performed. We don't believe that Bershauer holds that had to have been fully performed to assign a breach of contract action. But even if this court read it this way, that would not prevent it here, because this contract was performed as to the states of Washington and Oregon, which were passed to Frontier, severed out of any other territories under the contract. And secondly, Oregon has no language that even approaches anything in Bershauer, and appellees point to none. And so even under the narrowest holding of Bershauer, that it has to be fully performed, fully executed to pass the breach of contract action, we argue, yes, it was fully performed and executed, and in Oregon, there's no parallel anyway, so our rights would stand certainly under Oregon law. The second argument as to our capacity is that Frontier was effectively a party to the marketing contract. And I'll read the specific language from the marketing contract because I think it's important. Looking at the marketing contract in the very first paragraph, it's by and between Verizon Services Corporation, and I'll skip the address language, on behalf of its affiliated service provider companies listed in Exhibit A. And this is important, collectively referred to as the company or Verizon.
In Appley's brief, they argue that if Frontier was a party to an original party to the contract, why did you have to have an assignment? And I didn't see that you addressed that argument in your reply brief.
I'm happy to address it here. And that is very simple. Lawyers belt and suspenders all the time. If this court finds that we were effectively an original party to the contract, that ends the inquiry. There's no academic question about whether we can assign rights to ourselves and all those sorts of interesting questions. The question here is put quite forthrightly that company was included, Verizon Northwest, looking down the contract, now therefore language, company and developer, singular the party, collectively the parties, agree as follows. The trial court took judicial notice of the change of name from Verizon Northwest Inc. to Frontier Communications Northwest Inc. So therefore, and D.R. Horton has not argued otherwise. They've not argued the name change. They're just arguing the effect of this contract and whether we are original party or not.
All right, before you get away, time is about out.
Yep.
Tell me about voluntary payment.
Okay. Voluntary payment requires knowledge, right? And it's a question that comes up only if the marketing contract itself is unclear. The marketing contract is this. It covers developments under it. They're covered properties under Exhibit C. The question is, if that's all ambiguous, then we look to voluntary payment and, you know, that Verizon and Frontier knew that D.R. Horton was submitting for commissions homes that weren't closed, utterly vacant lots. That conflicts with the marketing contract.
The position is you had no knowledge that some of these lots were vacant. Some of these houses had been built for 2 or 3 years. You had no knowledge of that.
Your Honor, I think there are two things. One is they have to prove that beyond any genuine dispute of material fact. They haven't done it. I would suggest first and foremost that that last invoice they submitted called Portland January to June 2010 closings, not addresses, not vacant lots, not anything else, closings that they submitted for payment is an obvious indication that they were trying to pull the wool over Frontier and Verizon's eyes.
Not so fast. You're not, do you have any other questions?
Oh, yes, but...
Go ahead.
I'll wait.
Okay. You have any questions? Now, do you go by Robert, Bob, Robbie? What do you go by?
Well, Rob.
Rob, okay.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court, Robert Gilbreth for the appellee, D.R. Horton. I'd like to get us back on the proper legal footing on the question of whether this is an issue of standing or capacity. Texas courts treat this as an issue of standing rather than capacity. I didn't have a chance to file a SIR reply brief, of course, but I would direct the court's attention to one case. There are many. One fairly recent case on that is it's called Shipley versus Unifund, and it's at 331 Southwest 3rd, page 27. It's a 2010 case from the Waco Court of Appeals. There are others as well.
So if we're operating under Texas procedure and other states' substantive law, is standing or capacity a procedural question?
It would be a, I think you would say it's a procedural question, Your Honor. Most states treat this type of issue as just a pure matter of standing. It's not a particularly important distinction in this case because it only really affects the one argument that I raised for the first time on appeal. I said, well, since it's standing, I can make this argument that you questioned opposing counsel about earlier. It's not an argument that we need to win, but I thought it was an argument that ought to be brought to the court's attention. To be blunt about it, though, Frontier's purported assignment in this case is not worth the paper that it's written on. The law allows an assignment over an anti-assignment clause, even a general anti-assignment clause.
Okay, the law of?
Let's narrow it down then. It's the law of the two states in question. And
All right.
We have the most salient case from Washington, the Bershauer case. But the law allows an assignment over an anti-assignment clause only when it's an assignment, a specific assignment of a cause of action, not just rights, titles, and duties under a contract, but a specific assignment of a cause of action after performance is completed. Well, this wasn't an assignment of a cause of action. It was a general assignment, and it was not made after completion of the contract. Now, they've tried to quibble with that, but I would direct the court's attention to the first page of the contract. There's a provision called term of contract. And under that provision, this was an executory contract.
Where am I looking?
Page one.
Am I looking in the contract for marketing services? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
That's page one, about the second.
I got it.
Near the bottom, term of contract. Under that provision, this contract was still alive. In other words, we could continue to perform under this contract. Now, let me try to draw that distinction another way. In the Bershauer case that we've been talking about, there it was for construction of a school. And after the school was completely built, there was a lawsuit over whether it was built properly, and one of the parties assigned their claim, their cause of action against the architect, to another party. That's performance that's been completed. The school's built. Here you still have an executory contract we could continue to perform under. So let's, that answers okay, that
everybody
question.
Keeps talking about assigning causes of action. In my understanding, this is not an assignment of cause of action.
Exactly.
Like you might do if there's a tort or a breach of contract, you sell that and assign it to somebody else. That's not what this is.
Exactly.
This is assigning rights and duties under a contract. And, of course, with the contract comes possible breach.
Right.
Yes?
Right, right. And this, so,
okay.
And here's how it would work. They're partially right. You could have an assignment of a contract like they have here that would bring with it a cause of action for a breach of contract later on down the road.
At the time of the assignment, there was no breach, correct?
Right. And under that circumstance, it would filter through, right, because there's no fence. But the anti-assignment clause is the fence, and it stops any general assignment, including its little incidents, such as assignment of a cause of action that might be ancillary to the rights and duties. They want to say there's a hole.
What you're telling me, if I understand it, is that under certain circumstances, you can assign a cause of action, and that voids the anti-assignment clause. But you can't just make a general assignment in the face of the anti-assignment clause. Is that your position?
That's my position.
All right.
You could if you tried to assign a cause of action and then you did it after performance.
I understand.
Right, so it can't get through the fence, and they want to say it's a leaky fence, and this cause of action got through, but nothing else. But that just doesn't work. There's no law to support that. So, and they want to quibble with the language of the Bershauer decision, and so I will just very quickly quote for the court the precise holding in that case. I know it's not a good idea to read a lot of stuff at oral argument, but this will be quick. Court said, we therefore hold a general assignment clause, one directed at performance of the contract, does not, after performance is completed, prohibit the assignment of a cause of action for breach of contract. So we just don't fit under Bershauer here, and it blocks this assignment, attempted assignment. And Bershauer, just like all the other cases they cite, involved, again, I hate to beat a dead horse, an assignment of a cause of action, not a general assignment. Now, they want to rely on the Banque Arabe case from the Second Circuit, which was applying New York law. New York law doesn't govern. What we're talking about is the validity and the effect of the anti-assignment clause in the marketing contract, which is governed by Washington and Oregon law. And furthermore, there wasn't even an anti-assignment clause in the Banque Arabe case. The court was simply analyzing whether this general assignment also carried with it tort claims. And when you read the way that the court analyzed the language, it makes it very clear that that case is distinguishable because of the language and the way the court analyzed it. So Banque Arabe does not speak to our situation. So now I've shown that they don't have any rights under the assignment. And their backup argument is, we were a party to the marketing contract. We disagree that Frontier was a party to the contract, but even if it were a party to the contract, it cannot show that it sustained any damages that it could bring suit for as a party. You see, the contract in paragraph 6.11 negates any claims for lost profits or consequential or incidental damages. So they are here suing for one thing and one thing only. They want to recover the commission payments that Verizon made to D.R. Horton. Well, who made those payments? Verizon made the payments. It's undisputed that Verizon made all of those commission payments. And as we've shown in our brief, one corporation cannot recover damages sustained by another corporation, even if they're affiliates, even if they're working together and they're affiliates.
What was the, in his argument and in the briefing, there's a reference to the fact that the trial court took judicial notice of a name change.
Right.
If this was simply a name change situation, then the corporation remained the same entity. Its name just changed.
Yes. I agree completely with that. That's not our argument. They're saying they kind of wanted us to argue that Frontier was not really the same as Verizon Northwest, its predecessor. And we didn't bite on that argument. We don't want to fight that. We will concede that. But we still win because if Verizon Northwest, their predecessor, was a party to this contract, let's accept that, they still didn't pay any of these commissions. It was a separate corporation, Verizon Services Corporation, that paid all the money. So Frontier, as the successor in interest to Verizon Northwest, doesn't have a claim for damages because Verizon Northwest never paid any commissions. They're two separate corporations. They may be affiliates, and I'm sure they are, or were, excuse me, but even that fact, the cases say, doesn't allow Verizon Northwest to say, well, these guys paid all these commissions and I can sue for them. No, it has to be Verizon Services Company, unless, of course, there's an assignment, which we've shown there is no assignment.
Hey, had you finished your answer?
Yes.
Can you talk to me about course of performance and waiver?
Yes. There's a difference between course of dealing and course of performance under the law.
I think maybe it's Oregon Bank versus Nautilus.
Yes, Your Honor. And under the Oregon case law, you can look to course of performance to shine light on what the heck this contract means. How did the parties perform after the contract? Course of dealing is stuff that happens before you enter into the contract. Course of performance, even these, their no waiver clause, for example, in the contract, doesn't prohibit the court from looking at course of performance.
Exactly.
And I know the issue, Justice McCoy, you asked about the voluntary payment argument that we have. And I'd like to jump ahead, although I will like to talk a little bit more about the standing issue. But on voluntary payment, they say we haven't conclusively proved voluntary payment, but they're wrong. You don't have to look at anything but a couple of facts. First off, the contract, let's look at the contract. It does not state what homes are eligible. It states only what information Verizon is entitled to get to make a decision whether it wants to pay commissions on those. There is one provision where the parties carefully spelled out that you cannot have any homes outside of Verizon's franchise area, which I think should persuade the court. Well, if they wanted to limit this to new homes, they would have done so just like they did when they had that very specific limitation on houses outside the franchise area. But nonetheless, so we know the contract doesn't say what homes are eligible, but that Verizon has rights to certain information to make its decision. We know it's undisputed that Verizon did not ask for the information it was entitled to get, closing reports, move-in dates, and that sort of information. We can safely assume that Verizon knew what information it could get under the terms of the contract. I guess they're charged with having read the contract and knowing what it says. And then finally, the evidence conclusively establishes that Verizon paid commissions knowing that it did not get the information that it could have used, the new home reports, closing dates, buyer information. So they know exactly what they were doing, and you don't have to really dig around in the evidence to see that. It's just on the face of the contract. The fact that they paid commissions without asking for this information that would have told them whether the houses were new or old. Now, they want to argue that this contract, it's so clear on this contract that what the parties intended was just new homes. Well, I'd have to disagree with that. If you look at the first three whereas clauses, which pretty much spell out the parties' intentions on the first page, the first one, nothing about new homes. The second one, nothing about new homes. The third one, nothing about new homes. And you also have Verizon wants to market services to buyers, open paren, the buyers or residents. So they're making a distinction between people who are getting a new home and existing residents. So right there, you know, they're not trying to limit it entirely to new homes. They've contemplated new buyers and existing residents.
How does that address vacant lots or lots in which there was no residence, no closing, no buyer?
They have argued quite a bit about vacant lots, and that's just not what was going on here. There may have been a handful of vacant lots, and we don't know at this time. I don't think the evidence shows whether they've now been built on. But there may have been a very small handful of vacant lots. So what we're really dealing with is houses that were built before the date of this contract, houses that were not yet built when they paid commissions for them, but would be built in the future. And if there's a few lots left over, I don't think the evidence shows that, but they make quite a fuss about it, but it's not what was going on here. And of course, they knew exactly what they were paying for.
I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask anyway. What, if anything, do you think that this court should do about the trial court's failure to rule on the objections to, I think it's Gina White's affidavit? I mean, I know you say that they were in the midst of a bunch of other, but nevertheless, we don't know. I mean, all we know is that the trial court didn't rule. So we can't really jump to the conclusion he didn't rule because there were too many objections there. We don't know.
That's true. And I guess the court can make that decision for the first time on appeal. The judge did not abuse his discretion or err. I'm not sure what the standard is on whether or not, you know, ruling or not. But either way, the trial court did not err or abuse his discretion given the prolixity of the objections that were made here. I've never seen anything like it. I don't think that we should encourage parties to continue to do this sort of thing to trial judges who just are overwhelmed with that sort of paperwork. So, and then it's our position also that you really don't need the testimony of Gina White to decide these purely legal issues. She was giving background.
But you cite to her affidavit, as they point out in their reply brief, numerous times. So it seems like you're relying on it.
Oh, we do to tell the story, but often you can get the story and then dig in past the facts to the law, the plain words of the contract, the undisputed facts, and reach your decision that way. And I think having Gina White tell the story so that you understand what really happened here allows you to dig right into the law and the undisputed facts and reach your decision that way. So, unless there are any further questions, I will return the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a couple of quick things before we go back to the contract. First of all, I think D.R. Horton's trying to muddle the difference between New York law that governs the assignment of the cause of action versus Oregon and Washington that governs the effectiveness of the anti-assignment clause. The assignment assumption agreement is a document expressly governed under New York law. Therefore, that governs whether the assignment passed. Oregon and Washington law then come in to play to govern the determination of what the anti-assignment clause means within the marketing contract itself. And so that's how we've addressed it in our briefing, and I think that's the proper analysis for this court to undertake. And under Bank of Rob, it does apply here, and the agreement or the assignment of the contract does assign a cause of action under New York law, as Bank of Rob makes quite clear. Secondly, they suggest on our party argument that there's no damage here. That seems to be the crux of their argument, because Verizon Services paid, not Verizon Northwest Inc. Verizon, the only evidence of that I can find in the record are the checks, and I believe that's the only thing that they point to, that came out of a Verizon Services account. Now, you know, without going too much into the, you know, my history as a CPA, obviously affiliated corporations, and I think this is a matter of common sense, affiliated corporations often cut a single check out of a single bank account and then transfer price through the corporations. They charge back for what one corporation paid on behalf of another. They have never inquired, they have never taken a deposition of a Verizon employee to prove their case. They are under that affirmative obligation to prove we didn't make the payments, et cetera. They've never
done it. Timing of the payments and the timing of the assignment is?
The timing of the payments, all prior to June of 2010, assignment effective July 1st, 2010. All the payments were passed. All the payments that we're talking about here were passed.
So your argument then hinges on the fact that this attachment A, it sounds like to me that Verizon's making the payments, and here's this list of attachment A, and you say, well, Verizon Northwest, I think it is on A. Therefore, they've never proven that all the payments were from Horizon and not from Northwest?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's right. There's nothing. Verizon Northwest was a party here. They were entitled to performance under the contract. This idea of who paid, frankly, is just a mistake because Verizon Northwest was entitled to performance. Verizon Northwest ultimately paid, we would suggest, because that's how companies work. Companies are judged by their profits, you know, subsidiary by subsidiary. But if I could, just one thing in the commission payments section 4.3 of the contract, it didn't end with the signing of Exhibit C. It was $225 per home passed at each covered property, so at each development. And it says further, to be eligible to receive the commission.
Where are you reading so I can
I'm
read
sorry, 4.3 of the marketing contract, which is on.
Got it.
Okay. $225 per home pass at each covered property. Developer will be eligible to receive commission payment for a specific home once developer provides to the company new home address, new home. That's the commission payment eligibility. Finally, last sentence in that paragraph, each home must contain category or five better or better wiring in order to qualify for the commission payment. It didn't end with Exhibit C. D.R. Horton was required to provide new home addresses that they certified had Category 5 wiring. Obviously, it was not Verizon or Frontier's responsibility or ability to go out and check inside the walls of new homes to determine whether they had Category 5 wiring. As Verizon and Frontier's representative testified, she relied upon D.R. Horton to present qualified, eligible homes for payment. If D.R. Horton's position is to be taken seriously, they would have to argue that once an Exhibit C was signed covering a development, all 3,000, hypothetically, lots were due a commission. But they never billed them that way. They billed them 550 one month, 323 a couple months later. They never charged for all lots and addresses in one single fell swoop as a a prudent company obviously would if they were due those amounts.
But you never requested a closed home report or some other things that you had a right to have sort of to establish the veracity of what they're telling you.
Well, they did. And I'm sorry, my time's
go
out.
Ahead, go ahead.
They did, finally, with the June 2010 submission.
But the horses are out of the barn and down the road at that point.
Well, Your Honor, what I would suggest is that according to the testimony, and again, this is a genuine dispute of material fact issue, according to the testimony of Verizon and Frontier's representative, she depended upon them to submit eligible homes. That means new homes that were built. Clearly, vacant lots, et cetera, didn't fit that profile. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Darren, Rob, we appreciate your argument. It's, as you can tell, we have lots and lots of questions. And
I have a question before y'all leave that has nothing to do with this. Why are we here? Why are we in Fort Worth, Texas?